are listening to the Sermon Podcast from Real Life on the Palouse, reaching the world for Jesus, one person at a time.
I know I always start with a story, but today I'm going to start a little different because it's Father's Day and I am super thankful for my dad. So I just want to say that, like, I had a great childhood. My dad worked really hard to make sure that I had what I needed, and I can honestly say that I would not be the man that I am without him. So we have some pictures, I think. There's my dad. On the left, he is he played golf at OU. So he was a golfer there, and then he coached there. And then there's my dad and me on the right. And when I was first born, he was actually coaching at OU, I believe, at the time. So that's my dad. Now I'm going to tell you a little story about my dad. My dad and I, a few years ago, we went to the PGA Championship. One of my dad's college players was playing in it, and my dad went to help coach, and I was like, yeah, I'm coming. So we went, and we have this moment, we're eating lunch, and I realize Tiger's outside giving a press conference. So I go outside, and I mean, like, I'm 15 feet from Tiger while he's talking. And my dad comes up, and I was like, I'm going to get a selfie with Tiger. And he goes, okay, but don't ask him. Just stand right here. He's going to walk right here to the practice. And when he goes by, just, you know, take a little picture with him. And I was like, okay. So he's like, stand right here. This is where he's going. So I'm waiting, and Tiger does his interview, and then he heads the other way to the clubhouse. And I was like, oh. So I go up to the clubhouse, and I'm standing at the base of the steps, waiting for him to come back out to snap my picture. And my dad says, he had a pass, so he could go inside. And he says, I have to go to the bathroom. I'll be right back. And he goes inside, and I'm standing there waiting, and he sends me this picture. I was like, you sorry dog. You told me. And he goes, I didn't ask him. He came up. My dad was coaching golf when Tiger was playing in college, and Tiger said, oh, hey, coach, and came up. And my dad said, well, can I, you know. So he's like, he came and talked to me. But I was like, that's a likely story. But I just want to say, Dad, I love you. I appreciate all that you did. I didn't appreciate his advice so much when I was younger, but as I get older, it's starting to make a lot more sense. I'm sure some of you can relate to that. All right, now it's time for the story. When I was 21 years old, I picked up a hitchhiker at 2 a.m. on the side of a deserted highway. I am not encouraging anybody to do this. I'm not even encouraging you to pick up hitchhikers. I'm going to explain this, and hopefully it'll make sense. At the time, I was going to Oklahoma State, and some friends of mine said, hey, do you want to go to a Passion concert down in Edmond, Oklahoma? And I was like, I don't know what that is. And they're like, Charlie Hall will be there. And I was like, oh, I love Charlie Hall. I'll be there. And so we went down to Edmond, and we go to this Passion concert. And it's like 500, 600, maybe 1,000. I don't know. It was a lot of college students in this big church. And it goes on, and it's a great concert. We're doing all this stuff. They're talking about things. And afterwards, I'm hanging out with my friends. But I had to drive to my parents' house on the other side of Tulsa afterwards because I had to be in Tulsa in the morning. So it's after midnight when I leave, and I get on this highway that really, I mean, it really is pretty deserted, especially at 2 a.m. And I start heading down the road, and I'm like, I'm kind of pumped up from the thing. And I'm like, God, I just want you to use me. Like, find a way. Like, what can you do with me? Like, I want to do more. Use me more. God, do something. And I see this down the road. There's a truck on the side of the road broke down, and there's a guy outside. And the first thing that went through my head was like, God, you should really send somebody to help him because that stinks. Yeah, I figured it out too. And I was like, look at God, I don't know. I can't fix his truck. I don't really know all that much about it. Like, I wouldn't be a lot of help. You should probably, you know, I'm sort of giving God all these reasons why this is not what I meant. Right? If my beautiful wife would have been on the side of the road, I'd been like, yeah, God, this is what I was talking about. Use me like this. I'll pick her up. But this was not what I meant, God. And about the time I'm saying that, I'm dead even with him, going about 70. And I just, but I know you sent me. So I like slam on the brakes, like, you know, they're going to make a gift of that in the back. Watch.
And so I slam on the brakes. I pass him by like 500 feet and have to back up down the side of the highway to get to him. I get out and guy's about in tears. He's so upset. And I said, well, is there, you know, what can I, he's like, well, at the time we had these new things called cell phones. It was basically the same as the phone in your house, but it didn't have that bungee cord that you had to, you know, stay connected to the wall. Mine was a little Nokia brick thing, and it only had numbers on it and a little bitty, you know, tiny screen. And so if I wanted to text my name, I had to hit the 2 twice because it had A, B, C on the 2. So I had to hit 2, 2, and then I had to wait for it to move to the next place. And then I had to hit 3, 3 to get to the E, like, and so on. And that's why I still hate texting to this day. So if you're texting with somebody who went through that part of cell phones, don't be surprised if they have like this traumatic experience and don't want to text you back. Okay? But his cell phone was dead, and I had my first cell phone. My dad had given it to me. And so I was like, yeah, you can use my cell phone. He calls his wife, and she is worried sick. He is way late getting home. And I can hear them talking, and I realize through their conversation, it's about 45 minutes away. So he's going to have to wait for 45 minutes while she comes out, and then they still have a 45-minute trip home. And so I was just like, ugh. I know that if it's okay with you, I'll just drive you. It's mostly on my way. And he agreed, which I was kind of shocked about too. So he gets in my car, and we start down the road, and we start talking, and he says, well, I'm from outside of Cushing, Oklahoma. And I was like, my roommate is from Cushing. And I went with him and his home church in Cushing to Malawi, Africa on a mission trip last summer. And we start talking and he knows all these, like we know a lot of the same people, all this stuff. It's a really cool story. And he says, you know, I just want to tell you, I really appreciate that you stopped. He said, I've been out there over an hour and a half and nobody will stop. And I was like, I almost didn't. And I told him the story that I just told you. Now, I think that happens a lot, right? That we saw that last week. I think we're going to see this week. We want God to use us, and then he starts to, and you're like, not like that. That's not what I meant. And I think that's what's happening to the disciples. They want to be just like Jesus, only he's taking them to places and doing things that they are very uncomfortable with. Now today, as we walk through our text, we're going to do it like a 3-act play, okay? And we're going to have a little prologue at the beginning to help set the stage and then a little epilogue at the end. But we're going to divide it up into 3 pieces because I think there's one thing going on, but there's like 3 ideas to it. God is trying to change our hearts, okay? So in our prologue, to set the stage for our story today, I want to start in chapter 8. In chapter 8, Jesus meets this centurion, a Roman centurion, a Gentile, who has incredible faith and a servant who's suffering terribly. And Jesus, when he sees his faith, heals his servant immediately. Now, this faith of this Gentile, I think, sparks something in Jesus. And he leaves there, goes with the disciples to Capernaum, they get in the boat, and they cross over to the other side into the Decapolis. Okay, the Decapolis is the land of the, it's basically where the 7 Canaanite nations were sent. I talked about this a little bit last week when they were kicked out of Israel. It becomes the Decapolis. Okay, and so they go over there. Now, when they get there, apparently the disciples don't even get out of the boat. None of the Gospels record that anybody but Jesus gets out of the boat, anybody but Jesus is even there, and anybody but Jesus gets back in. And Jesus gets there, he gets out of the boat, and he runs into these 2 demon-possessed men that are so terrifying that nobody will even go anywhere around where they are. Jesus casts the demons out. They go into this herd of 2,000 pigs that run down the mountainside and drown in the water, which is pretty amazing because pigs are great swimmers. Okay? Then the people of the town hear about what Jesus has done, and they come out, and they're terrified, and they're like, please leave. Please go away. And so Jesus gets back in the boat. The 2 men come to Jesus and say, take us with you. They have an idea about what they want. And Jesus says, but that's not what I need. What I need is for you to go to your own people and tell them how much the Lord has done for you. And he leaves them there. They get in the boat and they cross the other side. And I can imagine that maybe Jesus is a little disappointed. After seeing the faith of the centurion, that's not really what we expect to see when we get to the Decapolis. And then from chapter 8 till chapter 15, there's no mention. He doesn't go back. He doesn't even look like he's planning on going back. And then we end up last week in Tyre and Sidon. We have a map that's going to show you kind of where we walked. So they start out here at Gennesaret. They walk up to Tyre and Sidon. They meet the Canaanite woman, another Gentile who has incredible faith, whose daughter is suffering terribly, and Jesus heals her like that. And once again, we see this incredible faith of a Gentile, and Jesus is like, well, maybe we should go back to the Decapolis and see if something's changed. And so they head down, they make that 50-mile trip and end up back in the Decapolis, very near to where he cast out the demons. And the question that I have is, what will we see? Will it be the same? Will he heal a couple people or nobody and they come and run him off? Or will things change? And that brings us to the opening act of our play. Jesus left there and went along the Sea of Galilee. Then he went up on a mountainside and sat down. I'm sorry, I got to pause for a second. I have giggled about this for all week. Every time I read this, it makes me laugh a little bit because I think about Jesus. I'm like, he's cast out demons. He's healed people. He even just walked on water and calmed a storm. And sometimes he just sits down. We have this little girl in our life group, and one day I go in, and all the kids were in my living room, and she's like on the ground with her head and her hands, her legs are up there. I was like, what are you doing? She goes, I'm just doing this. And I was like, I like that. I'm going to use that. And I kind of imagine Jesus at this point, like he's like, I'm just doing this. I'm just going to sit down. And he goes and he just sits down. Then great crowds came to him, bringing the lame, the blind, the crippled, the mute, and many others. And they laid them at his feet, and he healed them. The people were so amazed when they saw the mute speaking, the crippled made well, the lame walking, and the blind seeing, and they praised the God of Israel. So that's our first act. And I don't know about you, but it's not what we should have expected to see. We should have expected a pretty similar outcome from the first time, but something has changed. Something is very different. Because now when Jesus comes, there is an enormous crowd. We're going to find out thousands of people waiting for him when he gets there. And the question is, why? What changed between the last time and this time? And this is the only thing that I can think of. You remember those two men? The two that wanted to go with Jesus, and he said, no, go tell your story. Mark says they did. And I think this is the outcome. It's like these two guys were the greatest missionaries of all time, right? They're not Bible scholars. We don't even know if they're particularly smart, right? We don't know anything about them. The only thing we know is that they went and told their story. And their story is pretty simple, right? They were possessed by a legion of demons. They were suffering. They were lost. They had an encounter with Jesus, and he changed their life forever. That's all they have to say. So I imagine them going to their towns and people seeing them, right? They were so violent, no one could pass that way. Like, I think people probably recognized who they were. So they go to the town and it's like, oh, dude, are those the guys? Like, shh, do not say anything. Don't look at them. We don't want them to come over here. They could still be crazy. Like, don't, oh, too late. Here they come. But I want to know. And you say, what happened? And they say, listen, I was so lost. No one could help us. People had tried. They tried to chain us, and we just broke the chains. No one could help us. And then one day, we met a man named Jesus, and our whole lives changed. And if you need him, come with us. We're going to go see if he comes back. They have no reason to think he's coming back. And yet there's a huge crowd out there expecting him to show up. And when he shows up, they just bring people and lay them at his feet. It is a powerful thing to be at the feet of Jesus. The disciples sit at Jesus' feet because they want to know and they want to become who he is. So they sit at his feet and learn from him. In chapter 8, at the very beginning, there's a leper that runs up and kneels at Jesus' feet and says, "Help me." Peter, when he's sinking in the water, he sinks at Jesus' feet and says, "Lord, save me." Our Canaanite woman from last week comes and kneels at Jesus' feet and says, "Lord, help me." When you need Jesus, it's a great place to be. Just fall at his feet and say, "Lord, help me." Because that's what they do. And he heals them. Now, I always thought the healings were the best miracle, but it turns out that's not the most amazing thing that happens here. I'm going to explain it by doing one other story. God comes to the prophet Jonah, and he tells Jonah, "I need you to go to the Gentile city of Nineveh, and I need you to tell them that my wrath is coming. I've had enough, and I'm going to pour my wrath out on them. Go tell them." And Jonah's like, "No." And he goes and gets in a boat and he heads away from Nineveh on the Mediterranean Sea. God sends this great storm to the point where the people are throwing the cargo over to make sure the ship doesn't sink. And then finally they get Jonah and Jonah says, "Look, it's my fault. Toss me over and the storm will stop." And they don't want to, but they do. The storm stops immediately and Jonah is swallowed by a big fish. He's in the fish for 3 days and three nights, and then he's spit up on the shore, and then he still has to walk like 120 miles to get to Nineveh. When he gets to Nineveh, he tells them, "God's wrath is coming," and they repent and believe. And I always thought, like, the miracle was the 3 days and three nights in the fish, right? Like, how would you live? But it turns out maybe Jonah didn't. Maybe God resurrected him on the shore. But I thought that was the miracle, but not in Jewish tradition. In Jewish tradition, the miracle is that the Gentiles believed. That's the sign of Jonah. And if you look at the last sentence in these verses, what does it say? "And they praised the God of Israel." That is the amazing piece. Like, don't get me wrong, the other things are amazing, but this is the most amazing thing. People who don't know God have no reason to hear him, have no reason to listen to him, no reason to turn to him, are. Because they know their life is not what they want, and they want something different. They see Jesus, and they praise the God of Israel. And so as our first act draws to an end, we have this crazy thing like, that is not what we... Look, we started off with a twist. This is amazing what's happening. I can't wait to see what happens in Act 2. What will there be next? And Act 2 starts like this. "Then Jesus called the disciples to him and said, 'I have compassion for these people, for they have already been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. I don't want to send them away hungry, or they may collapse on the way.' The disciples answered, 'Where could we get enough bread in this remote place to feed such a crowd?' 'How many loaves do you have?' Jesus asked. 7 and a few small fish. He told the crowd to sit down on the ground. And then he took the 7 loaves and the fish. And when he had given thanks, he broke them and gave them to the disciples, and they in turn to the people. They all ate and were satisfied. And the disciples picked up 7 basketfuls of broken pieces that were left over. The number of those who had ate was 4,000 men besides women and children. After Jesus had dismissed the crowds, he got into the boat and went to the vicinity of Magadan. Okay, so now we're in Act 2, and it just keeps going. Right? It just keeps going. Jesus says, look, I have compassion for these people. I'm hoping you do too. They've been with me 3 days and have nothing to eat. Let that sink in for a second. Because I know y'all can't even make it through service without your coffee and your cocoa and all. Like, I see some of you trying to hide it. 3 days. Now, we had a discussion. Did they really not eat for 3 days, or did they just run out of food somewhere along the way? I don't know the answer to that. But I know that it's been long enough that Jesus is worried about them passing out on their way home, right? So it's been a significant portion of those 3 days, at least, that they've been out of food. And I think about, like, why? And one of the other guys said, well, there's certainly a bacon shortage going on, right? If you remember, when we were here the last time, Jesus drove the demons into the 2,000 pigs. They run down the mountain and they drowned. Now, moving here from Texas, we have a lot of wild hogs, and I've heard a lot of things about pigs, so I was like, I'm going to research this a little bit just to make sure that everything I've heard is accurate. And so I got on my computer, and then I realized, like, I have a friend who owns a hog farm. I'm just going to call him. So I call my friend. I wanted to talk to him anyway. I call him, and I was like, tell me about pigs. He goes, okay. He said, I have 5,000 sows, 5,000 female pigs that can have babies. He said, every year I expect to get 150,000 pigs out of them. And I was like, you don't have just a hog farm. Like, you have like a hog farm. That's amazing, 150,000 pigs. And I said, let me ask you this. If we just slaughtered the 2,000 that we have, do you think we could feed 100,000 people? And he's like, oh yeah, it's a lot of food. You can feed a lot of people with one pig. And I said, okay, if 1,000 of those are sows, how many pigs would I have at the end of the year? He said, if I had 1,000 sows, I would expect another 30,000 pigs at the end of the year. So this is like an infinite supply of food. I mean, as long as you take care of them and not, you know, you'll have a natural disaster, you know, something happened. But they could have just ate and ate and ate on these pigs indefinitely, it seems like. That's a lot of food. And now they show up and they're hungry, and Jesus says, I want to feed them. And I'm amazed by that. So he goes to the disciples, and they're like, again, right? They didn't ask him to send them away this time, but they do say, like, Jesus, where are we going to get enough bread out here? There's not a drive-through. Where are we going to get bread? And Jesus says to them, how many loaves do you have?
Seven and a few fish.
What?
Seven and a few fish.
How many? We have 7 loaves and a few fish, Jesus. Like, we don't have enough for us. This won't feed the 13 of us. It's all we have. If you take this, we're going to be hungry too. And I actually really empathize with the disciples here, because I realize, like, I have struggled sometimes with feeling like what I have isn't enough. God, you can't send me to do that because what I have is not enough for them. And he says, show up and give me what you have and let's see. Let's see if I can make it enough. And he takes their food and he feeds them. And there are leftovers, right? There are 7 basketfuls left over. Now, why 7? Well, if you remember in the feeding of the 5,000, when they feed them, there are 12 basketfuls left over, and we're in the land of the Jews, in the land of the 12 tribes of Israel. Now we're in the land of the 7 Canaanite nations, and we have 7 basketfuls of leftovers. It's almost as if God is saying, I have enough for the Jew, I have enough for the Gentile, and there will be leftovers. It's almost like a challenge, like, try to bring more people than you think I can feed. Let's do that. Let's prove him wrong. Let's be like, God, we're going to prove you wrong. We're going to bring so many people that you can't feed them. I once tried to prove God wrong
It didn't go very well. I was like, I'm going to do it, God, just to prove you wrong. And it was like, did not work out in my favor. But God has leftovers. Now, one thing I want to point out real fast is I always thought Jesus feeds the 4,000. If you look in your Bible, that's what the heading says, right? Jesus feeds the 4,000, but he doesn't. He takes the loaves, and when he had given thanks, he breaks them, and he gives it back to the disciples. They, in turn, feed the 4,000, or however many, 10,000, however many people are here. And I wonder, like, did they have a chance to just be like, well, this is ours, we're going to eat it. But they know what Jesus wants. And so they take it and they feed everyone and they're all satisfied. God's saying, just bring what you have. I will make it enough. Bring what you have. My wife's uncle Marion told a story at his mother's funeral, and I'm going to tell it. It was about little Johnny. Little Johnny was late getting home from school and his mom was very worried. And he finally gets home and she says, Johnny, where have you been? He says, Mama, on the way home, I saw Billy. He was on the side of the road. He was crying. She said, well, why was he crying? He said, well, his bike was broken. And so I stopped to help. She said, Johnny, you don't know anything about fixing a bike. He said, oh, Mama, I didn't stop to help him fix his bike. I just stopped to help him cry. I don't know what your gifts are. I don't know what your talents are, but I know that you have some, and God is just saying, just bring what you have, and I will make it enough. And our act two draws to an end. This is the place where we should have intermission, so if you need to get up and get something, you know. I'm just kidding. Sit down. Don't get up. Huh? Right? So we're waiting on what is going to happen. Like, the first act, we didn't expect. The second act, we still don't expect it. And we come into the final act where Jesus leaves the Gentiles and goes back to the Jews. And so now our expectation is, well, if this is what the Gentiles can do, we can certainly do more when we get to the Jews. But here come the antagonists. So we get there. Jesus crosses back over to Magadan, and this is what happens. Then the Pharisees and Sadducees came to Jesus and tested him, asking him to show them a sign from heaven. He said, when evening comes, you say the weather will be fair, for the sky is red. And in the morning, you say today it will be stormy, for the sky is red and overcast. You know how to interpret the appearance of the sky, but you can't interpret the signs of the times. A wicked and adulterous generation looks for a sign, but none will be given it except the sign of Jonah. Then Jesus left them and went away. They come to Jesus, and instead of falling at his feet, they say, give us a sign. Show us that you are who you say you are. And Jesus says, you just missed it. You just missed the sign of Jonah. If you had gone with me, you would have seen the Gentiles praising the God of Israel. But you were too worried about being clean. You were so worried that they would make you unclean. You didn't go out to them. Otherwise, you would have seen the sign you were looking for. You've taken what God gave you and you've turned it inward. You see, God's original plan for the Jews was that they would be his kingdom of priests, his hands and feet to the rest of the world. That's what it means to be a priest of God. When people come and meet with you, it is as if they are meeting with God himself, and you are supposed to minister to them in the way that God would do it, so that they see his love, they see his compassion, and they know who he is. Jesus just did this in the Decapolis. That's what God wants from them. But instead, they're just worried about, are you clean enough? Are you clean enough? Am I clean enough? They've forgotten their mission. God says in Isaiah 49,
When I send the Redeemer of Israel, he says that he's going to do this. He says, it is too small a thing for you to be my servant, to restore the tribes of Jacob and bring back those of Israel I have kept. I will also make you a light to the Gentiles, that my salvation will reach to the ends of the earth. I promise you, to them, even though it's only like 8-10 miles from where they were to the Decapolis, that felt like the ends of the earth. This is a place where they don't recognize how these people live at all. It is foreign to them. It is wrong. And Jesus takes the disciples there. Now imagine if they'd come here. Like if that 10-mile stretch is the ends of the earth, imagine what they would think about Moscow, Idaho. That's a long way from Israel. When we moved here 3 years ago from Texas, I drove 2,000 miles to get here with the help of my dad. He flew down and rode with me for the first 24, doing a lot of the driving. And that's just a fraction of how far it is to get to Israel from here. And it also had to travel 2,000 years through history so that you could hear it. People have been carrying this story of Jesus for 2,000 years through history to me and now to you. He might have only been sent to the lost sheep of Israel, but his message, his kingdom, is for the world. What will you do with the message you get today? Because what God is saying is, be open to what I want you to do. Don't be surprised. Don't be afraid. Take what you have, and I will make it enough. Just go. Just go. Now, I want to wrap this up with an epilogue, which basically means we're going to move to communion. So if you need one, raise your hand. And if it's your first day, if today's the day where you're like, I really have never met Jesus before, and you want to, come find me afterwards. I want to wrap it up this way. Because when we say these words every week, Jesus took the bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and he gave it to the disciples, right? Where else have we heard that today? It is echoed in the story of the feeding of the 4,000. Jesus took the 7 loaves and the fish, and when he had given thanks, he broke it. And he gave it to the disciples and said, I will feed you, but I need you to feed the rest of the world. I will take care of you. You take care of them. Remember my story. Remember what I've done. Let us remember. And then Jesus took the cup. He said, this is my blood poured out for you and for many. When you do this, remember me. Let us remember. Blessed are you, O Lord our God, King of the universe. Father, I just thank you for all that you have done. God, I thank you that you made that journey across the Sea of Galilee to reach out to Gentiles like us, to push the message so that we would hear it someday. God, to say to us, what you have is enough, just bring it. I just want a partner. God, help us just to see what it is you want us to do and how we can be used, and let us be willing to step into that. Change our hearts, Lord. Change our hearts. We ask this in Jesus' precious name. Amen.
Thanks for checking out this message from Real Life. You can find out more about us by visiting liferotp.com and connecting with us on Facebook and Instagram. Until next time, have a great week.